Morning, everyone. So, day three. Today we've got the council staff reporting back. So we've had, obviously, three statements, or extra statements, pre-circulated. We've had a chance to read those. And we've got a further supplementary evidence from Ms. Jones. I mean, I think it would be good to get the Dr. Reed, Ms. Palmer, isn't it, and Galabazi, is that right? Yep, to go. I mean, obviously, we read the material, but I think it would be helpful if there's anything particularly you want to, you know, draw our attention to, please do so. And probably we'll start there. And I think when we get to the end, Ms. Jones, probably you'll need to read through your statement since that's one we haven't. We've only just got now. Yeah. Okay. So.
Circulated, I'd just like to start with an apology, maybe one more read through the material before it was dispersed would have found this mistake, but I wanted to correct paragraph 56, which is sort of a key paragraph in terms of speaking to part two of the Resource Management Act. If you don't mind, I've prepared a substitute paragraph that I can just give you to replace that one. And also I wanted to clarify whether or not with the circulated evidence, my attachment B, which had a map that looked like that on it, should have also had a map that looked like that on it. And when I printed my PDF out last night, that map didn't print, and I just wondered if you'd seen that map.
Now that's the supplementary statement you're
talking
about?
Yeah, the supplementary.
No, I don't think so.
You haven't seen that one? Okay, so I've got copies of those as well. So, because when it didn't print out on mine last night, I just thought, oh, okay. Thanks. In my first evidence, the really key points to consider in the overall information that both Dr. Bramley and I are trying to convey regarding the site, and I'm speaking only for myself, of course, was that we need to accept certain things about what was in order to understand the value of what is, in order to go forward in our focus with what could be at the site. And so belabouring the points of what was is not, it's a shame that we've come to a disagreement on that particular aspect of the site, the nature of the site. But it's my opinion that what was is quite important because it addresses much of the way we manage it. It addresses much of the way we make decisions about whether or not what's there is significant or not, because we use the understanding of what it was to make decisions about whether what's left is important or worth keeping and significant, and if so, how significant. So those arguments about what was are really important from that point of view. If we stay on my position that I've researched and I've used to form my view, I think that referring to the attachment to the map that shows the modelled potential vegetation that's pre-human. And we look at that historic vegetation as a model, and this is based on not only regression modelling about species-environment relationships, but it so happens that the production of this model of historical pre-human vegetation matches all of that sub-fossil research and all those other things. Wardle in 2001, which is a key reference for Mr. Bramley's argument about what was and what could be, that he provided a benchmark description of the distribution of forest, recent forest. And so he's talking about where is forest now, and that was published in 2001. It accords with the historic distributions of what people model and think of what was. It accords with the benchmark surveys that were done by Burrell, who was cited by Wardle, about where Kānaka was and where Kānaka climax communities were. These things all match together, and they fit with my understanding of the way, and I've been informed by those in terms of forming my opinion about what was, what is, and what could be. So I rely on those sorts of models that come along. The lens models, which you will be familiar with quite a few hearings, and maybe they've been referred to, and Dr. Bramley explains what the lens models are in his primary report. Those came along in 2003, and they were published in 2003. The benchmark for those lens things, and what we say the historical vegetation for using lens, is about 1840s. It's about looking at what was there when Europeans colonised, what was left by the time Europeans colonised. And so when we think about historical veg in that benchmark, it's from when Europeans colonised and what was left when we came. And so when we think about loss, we're thinking about the sort of loss that we created post-European colonisation. And so when we think about restoration, a lot of the restoration models acknowledge that 500-800 years ago, we burnt, the first colonisers of New Zealand burnt a lot of what was there. 500 years ago. It's been gone a long time. So are the mowers and so are all the ecological engineers that were part of those ecosystems. They're gone, long gone. Mid-1800s, we had Kānaka and we had beech forest on the fringes of the mountains, and that matches the pre-human models. And so when we think about what was, that's what we're talking about. So when we say, okay, so when we think about what's significant, we think about all those representativeness, we think about connectivity, we think about the size of what's left, we think about is there anything rare in there, and that's 2007, the threatened environment classification models came along. And those are another tool for us to say, okay, of what was there in the mid-1800s, what's left? And in this particular site, we have a threatened environment. And that means less than 10% is left on a national scale. And it so happens in this area, less than 3%, 2.5% on a national scale of the vegetation associated with this land environment is left. And of that, 0.7% is protected. And that speaks to the issues of vulnerability for further loss. And some of the research that's been done and published by Susan Walker from Landcare Research Team suggests that when threatened plants or existing remaining indigenous vegetation remains in a threatened environment and that land is not protected, it's very vulnerable to future and further loss. So what we've got here at this site is indigenous vegetation representative of the historical 1840s and pre-human, according to the Leithwick models, vegetation left, a small scrap that's been chased to the northern margin of the peninsula in an area where it was once more widespread. There's not very many examples of this left. It's modified. Much of what remains in the threatened and acutely threatened environments throughout the country is modified. Searching for the best examples means that you increase the potential vulnerability of loss of what is left because most of it's modified by rabbits, by fire, by farming. It's modified. So what I look to then is what's the potential for this site? What's the future for this site? Okay, we have decisions to make. You know, when we approach a site like this as a land manager, we choose to lose more, or do we choose to protect, enhance, and maintain what's left? And that's a decision that's basically on the table of this application for plan change in this particular area. We've established that there are species that have elements of rarity. We've established that there's at least four at-risk species left at this site. Okay. Some of them are in decline. Some of them, falcon, is in recovery. Some of them are naturally uncommon, but they're associated with the communities that are left at this site. So thinking about that, the alternatives in terms of the proposal, and this speaks to the paragraph that the choices that we have in relation to the ecology of the site, you've heard some talk with status quo, partial development, full consent of a rezoning in 26 lots. The spectrum sits somewhere within there. And so if you think of status quo, no rezoning, leave it as open space, what's going to happen? We've heard Dr. Bramley talk about the sustainability of the site and the short tussock grass and the fescue grassland that's in there. That's a modified small portion of fescue grassland. And so we think, well, is it worth protecting? Can we protect it? What happens, you know? So if we do nothing and we leave it, no change of zoning, conifers from that plantation are going to keep coming. The seed rain is coming, okay? That plantation's probably not going to be there forever. At some point in the future, someone's probably going to want to take some of those conifers away. Some of them, all of them, they're going to have a natural life. Sooner or later, that conifer plantation's going to change. Rabbits are there. Rabbits are a problem. And those two things are the main problem faced by that reserve, and that's not uncommon anywhere else in any of the other threatened environments that are around the country. In fact, there are, go to Mackenzie Basin, wild and conifers. These things are prevalent issues. So in this particular setting, rabbit control can happen on a public piece of land. It can happen on a private piece of land. You simply have to put the notices out, inform the public. I have to do some public consultation, but people do control pest animals on public land. It happens. It's part of life. So it's not necessarily an obstacle. Changes in rabbit populations are also going to happen. The Australians have gotten permission to release the K5, the Korean strain of the Khaleesi virus. They've got permission to release that in autumn next year. On the back of those trials, if they're successful over there, they think that virus can probably take down about 30% of the rabbit population, like the uncontrolled release of Khaleesi did a while ago. The Animal Health Board want to control the release of that virus if it's successful here. It's just a tool. Control of rabbits at this site is never going to be eradication. It's only ever going to be taking the pressure of browse down at this site so that you can get some plants away. Okay? If you look at my attachments, in particular attachment 1E at the Whitechapel Reserve, before that map. So here, there's two photos I've given you there. This is the Whitechapel Reserve near the Arrow Junction. This is a public, the Wataru Reforestation Group that's done some planting out there at this reserve. It's a public reserve, it's administered by DOC, no rabbit control before they started planting. What they've got there, if you look at the two pictures, they've got rabbit netting around the planting. They've got guards on guards. The rabbits have eaten the guards to get to the plants. They've come under the fence or around the fence because it's not very well maintained, and they're eating the plants. That's a grey shrubland community that's been planted there. Regardless of what you plant at this site, if you don't control the rabbits are coming for your plants. So there's a cost associated with protecting your plants from rabbits that you can minimise by controlling rabbits if you intend to plant. So Kānaka's regenerating, and this is something Dr. Graham has talked about. If you don't do anything, Kānaka's going to keep invading the short tussock grassland, just like the conifers will. That's okay. That's okay. When you look at climax communities and natural succession and these kinds of places, what we've had is the persistence of a combination of open ground and mat-forming species, low-stature herds of grasses and shrubs. In this environment, they've been there a long, long time. And if you look at Burrell, 1965, her description of the ecology of Kānaka communities and climax communities, that's what Kānaka communities look like. regeneration happens and it balances with death, and the open space is maintained. Okay, so the fact that that Karnaka might regenerate into the open space is not a problem. It's the fact that we're dealing with such a small place that we have this tension about how do we best manage that community going forward. It's my view that if you stuck with the status quo, you're still going to have something to manage unless you just want conifers and rabbits in the Karnaka and short tusked grassland. That's what will happen if you do nothing. What you could do is the alternative is that you've got a proposal here to change the zoning and do some development. And we're grappling with what are the benefits or ecological benefits that could accrue from that opportunity. And so if we look at this area, I would say from my point of view, in terms of maintaining the ecological integrity of the site, you really don't want to put sections 13 to 26 in there. You'll basically take out the best of what's left if you put those sections into play in there, okay? If you restrict the development to a lot 1 to 3 and 7 to 11, you don't have a lot of loss in there. It's pretty much pasture grass, and it's been modified quite substantially. There's really nothing to speak of left in that area in terms of what the historic community was. So you have opportunity there to not lose ecological values whilst introducing a development. And the mitigation remediation associated with allowing development in that sort of place could be, and still get a good ecological gain out of the site, it could be protection from threat. It could be enhancement of the existing values by supplementary planting and supporting the nature of the site, supporting the communities that have been there for a very, very long time and are persisting and could be retained through some better custodial management of that site. So you could protect, enhance through supplementary planting and then maintain that. Maintenance means keeping rabbit numbers under control and making sure wild and conifers don't get a foothold on the site. So you could do that, and that would be probably the more cost-effective way that supports the integrity of the ecosystem values that are there that could arise. If you don't do that development, then the opportunity to do that isn't completely lost. Because if you don't do any development, there's nothing that prevents community groups from engaging in this piece of open space to do what they do down the Clutha River and in the numerous other sites that are revegetated through the volunteer efforts of the likes of Te Kākanaro Forest of Bird, the Wakatipu Reforestation Site on this side of the hill, on the other side of the hill. Nothing prevents that. The opportunity doesn't go away. It might simply be deferred until an unknown period of time. So there are those elements that wrap around the opportunities that are here. So there's a tension in terms of the recommendations that are being made by Dr. Bramley and I about what's the appropriate sort of vegetation that's there. The templates that are offered in their revised plans, there's a little bit of uncertainty associated with the templates that they've put in. And through my discussions with Dr. Bramley, I'm of the opinion that he sees introducing beech forest communities into the site as being a positive benefit for biological diversity. If you measure biological diversity improvements as more species must be better, then there's increased diversity because you've put species into the place. But if you're talking about protecting the integrity of what's there, it's not necessarily a good solution, given that it's in an acutely threatened environment and a representative community of what was. So I challenged Dr. Bramley to say, why did you want to put beech forest into this place? Is it about screening? No, it's not about screening. It's about his vision for what's appropriate for this place. And if that's the case, then we have a differing of opinions about what's appropriate for the place. His proposal, and in the I've been given this table that talks about the net profits and losses at the sites in terms of planting. And in it, he's saying that he's planting Karnaka and Tussock. In fact, if you follow the discussion that I understand from Dr. Bramble's evidence, he's talking about a mosaic of beech forest and Kanaka and grassland. And it's my contention that this is a small space in the big picture. Planting some beech forest here isn't going to nudge the site towards a beech forest succession. Do we want a beech forest succession to happen on this threatened environment with this community? I don't think so. From an ecological perspective, in terms of protecting the integrity of the site, I don't think we want to nudge this site towards a beech forest succession. So from that point of view, some of the additional planting that's proposed where lot 1, 6, and 5 were would create potentially a beech forest with a grassland glade in the middle and a seat that overlooks that grassland glade that's going to be surrounded by 20 metre high, if they achieve their potential, maybe 10 to 20 metre high in that area. That's a park. That's a park. So if we want to create a park with those landscape elements, that's fine, but it doesn't support the natural inclination of the site in terms of the site's natural biodiversity. And that's a point where we've spent a lot of effort talking about what was and what should be and what could be. There's been a lot of energy put into that question. And I think from my point of view, keeping it simple here is the best way to go to support the integrity of that site, working with the inclination of the site, working with the nature of the site, and supplementing and enhancing what's there is the better outcome for the ecology of that site. And that's essentially the crux of what I'm talking about in my supplementary evidence, and with my, sorry to have not proofread that one more time and picked up paragraph 56, but in terms of the proposal, if I may just read that to you because you haven't had a chance to read it before, in terms of whether the proposal better meets the or enables part 2 of the Resource Management Act in this situation, more is not necessarily better. And when I personally am planning to balance the site with its surrounding environment and its ecological context that it shares with its existing environment, I'm looking to protect, enhance and maintain the life supporting capacity of those existing values as the preferred option. The proposal has been amended to improve ecological outcomes for the site, and while I can't support the loss of the values affected from lots 13 to 26, rezoning to facilitate the subdivision and the development of lots 1 to 3 and 7 to 11, coupled with some rabbit control, followed by some supplementary planting that enhances the integrity of that existing vegetation, is a representative example of a historically more widespread community that will result in a valuable ecological outcome. I don't support the establishment of beech forest communities at this site as a replacement for cleared vegetation, but I don't object to the inclusion of some beech forest trees as a scattered representation in the site. But I put that sort of inclusion as landscaping element. And if there's a need to screen some of the development from lake views, say, and that's why they're wanting to push a taller tree into that place, then from a landscaping perspective, you know, maybe there's a place to cluster some trees around, but I don't advocate for a beech forest in that area. So that's essentially the crux of the evidence that I'm putting before the panel to consider in terms of determining impacts on ecology at the site.
Okay, thanks for that, and thanks for the evidence and that summary. Just to sort of start at the back end, I guess, if the plan change, you know, did go ahead, modified or not, but the idea of some sort of revegetation was there, could the debate about the sort of mix between the kānuka versus the sort of beech trees, the sort of final point you're making, I mean, presumably that's something that could be worked through some sort of management plan process or something where, you know, the idea or the principle of, okay, well, there's got to be this area of revegetation, exactly what it is, the control, rabbit control, mix of species. Presumably it could be something that's sorted out through some sort of management plan process that was the sort of, you know, available. So the concern you've got at the moment in terms of the beech trees just seems to be in terms of what's been put forward in terms of the current structure plan. You feel the current structure plan sort of got this emphasis towards beech trees.
I think the revegetation elements in that structure plan
have
got the wrong community for that site.
Right.
But I'm also really concerned about the loss of the values that are in lots 13 to 26.
Oh, no, I was going to get on to that point. That's right. Yeah, no, I'm sort of working backwards. Yeah. We talked about earlier about what should there be some sort of management plan process if you know, we went down that route or not. In terms of lots 13 to 26, and you sort of mentioned there, oh, those are the areas with the sort of the highest values. I'm quite sure to understand when you talked about the highest values. Is that in terms of just the area that's proposed for rezoning, which is basically sort of lots 1 through to 26, that sort of strip of land, or is that in terms of the whole of the open space zone?
Can I?
Sure. Yeah. You may want to just flick it around a little bit. Yeah. I don't know if Mel will be able to see completely. Yeah.
Is that all right?
Sure, they can shift.
Sorry. With the surveys that we've done to try and look at where is what's valuable on the site, the at-risk species have been found, and I'm talking about the prostate bluegrass that grows through it, the pimelia Raiolia boverdii, and potentially, and Stephen sent me a photograph of a plant she found down in lot 13 that looks like it's Caprosma brunia, which is a data deficit species, means that basically its threat status hasn't even been assessed. So, but those things are all present through this area and along the fringe and next to what was lot 6. They're in this area through here. This area down here grades more into pasture grass that's through here. So this is where the values, or this is where those threatened plants are.
The threatened plants are.
They're at risk.
At risk.
So they're in this zone here. And this is where you've got the contiguousness with the community that spreads along and goes down the Clutha River. This is the band that's through here. Okay, so when we take out this chunk here, we're actually taking out where those remnants are. They're modified, but I believe they still have some resilience, that if we take threats away, we can retain them as an example. And this is an area where we're talking about has quite a recreational benefit as well. So you have an advocacy opportunity in terms of educating people about loss and the need to protect from further loss. You have an opportunity to come through this area and interpret that information for people to say, this is a community worth protecting. It's small, but it's all we've got. So in this area. So this is the area where those values are.
Right. Has that been surveyed, or is there any information we've got sort of shows that geographically?
Any
maps or anything?
I think probably what people have done, as I have, is referred to the overlay of the proposed subdivision to give you a geographical boundary. So we've said this was in lot 20, so that... up in here, that's lot 20, so that's geographically on the site where it is. This was near lot 6, so it's up in here.
Yeah.
And so we've used the overlay of the subdivision to orientate the information about where the values are.
Yeah, right. Okay.
By the developer to make it so, to basically implement what was approved by the Environment Court.
Where that is as part of the spread development, I guess, what's the long-term management?
The long-term management is just completed its 10-year maintenance, and so that now is a site that's released to the individual landowners. And so the individual landowners have basically, as they've bought the site and moved in, I've been able to sort of communicate to some of those landowners what we've done and alert some of them to what they need to do to keep it going. But it's going to be over to those people, and it's interesting because as they've come in,
you know, three of them have said, oh, that's brilliant, that's really good, really like what, you know, what's here, and they know what's going on. But if they do it, if they don't do it, then you're going to get conifer rain, and in this case, sycamores are going to be coming into those sites. But
okay, but just looking at now at this particular site, would you envisage come up in May of what's going to be developed with the developer proposing to do some of the enhancement work with maybe the long term management of that, put forward back to council and reserve for?
My understanding of what's being proposed here is that the applicant's amended, as a result of some concerns raised about that, they've amended the proposal to put more of the planting into an open space to a territory, which means that council would have to, if it's vested in council, then council becomes obligated to do whatever future management is going to be required on the site. I see they've also left some of the planting inside the boundary of Lot 21, and so going forward, that's where the short tussock grassland is. And so if we try to maintain what's there rather than replace it with like conifer macro, which grows up above 1,600 metres in the hills, try and bring back down onto the flat down here and plant it in there, call it grassland, it doesn't. You're vulnerable to anything that's on private land over time just being gardened away, in my view, in my experience. The plantings that get put into open space and vested with council will then fall to possibly public-private partnerships, is the way of the world, with maintaining. So council engages with local community groups. That's a model that council has to determine in terms of what they're prepared to budget and what they're prepared to do on the land. It will require management. It will, in staying management, it will require, once the plants are established, then it's really about controlling the conifer seed rain and the seedlings of conifers in there and keeping check of rabbits. Because once plants get away, then they can be a bit more robust to a little bit of browsing every now and again. But it's when the plants are in their establishment phase, if the growth tips keeps getting eaten by the rabbits, then they're going to struggle. So management going forward is either going to fall to council, who's going to have to fund it, or form partnerships with community groups to manage it, or the private landowners are going to have to do it. And that was a concern I raised about the ongoing monitoring and maintenance of that community and vulnerability to loss when values are held in private ownership, is that you have someone could gradually mow it out, gradually plant it to something else. It would morph to whatever the private landowner, and if you're not looking over the fence and doing backyard checks, you're not going to know.
The at-risk species, transplantable, you know, could be shifted.
I wouldn't trust it, and I say that only because a few years ago, there was a decision made in Hawea Flat to transplant Rolia bovirdii, same map species that's here,
right.
And Leptonella, which is a button daisy. It's a ground cover species, herbaceous ground cover.
Right.
And the resource consent there required those plants to be taken out of a building platform footprint and put into a dry north-facing bank nearby,
right,
to retain them at the site.
Yeah.
And in my evidence, I've talked about the success,
right,
of that.
This is
and
what you mentioned.
And it wasn't great. Right. And it wasn't great because the rabbits came and dug up around the transplanted pieces, and the disturbance of the soil released suckling clover, which suppressed plants, and it wasn't weeded and it wasn't irrigated, and so it didn't really do that well. The grasses, you know, they're really most visible. This grass is really most visible when it's produced its long culm, and that's how you pick it in the grassland really easily. Without that long culm, it's really, really hard to find.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that you could walk through the site and dig them up and move them, yeah, you could do that, but and the grass will probably handle that a lot better than the mat-forming Rolia. And the Pimelia, it's because it's got a woody structure underneath, I don't rate that as a way of protecting those species in this site. You could try it, but I wouldn't rely on it.
Again, I think we've heard from the requester, well, you know, this time around there'll be a proper management plan, there'll be a 5-year maintenance period, all those sort of things about irrigation, and so, you know, more sort of hands-on management will be there compared to perhaps the case that you mentioned.
And you can't buy that species, it's not commercially available.
Yes.
The grass.
Yes.
Has DOC been involved, given that they control the land once you get over the place of it?
I think I read an evidence and I haven't seen a DOC submission.
I don't think they have. I thought they may have had some interest given they control the adjacent area. Too busy. Is there an option where, this is completely hypothetical, where the extent of revegetation, replanting is made bigger, you know, in case some area does get modified, earthworks and most of the things on, transplant, relocate what it can, the areas that are shown in the plan, you know, to address some of the issues, I guess some of the risks that you're talking about, you know, not perhaps getting established, and there is a sort of this lost opportunity that comes from that area being developed. Should the area that gets revegetated sort of be larger than what's been proposed? Often you sort of see 2-to-1 sort of ideas rather than sort of a more 1-to-1 sort of idea, and I guess that's part of that sort of, it's a net benefit, but it's a sort of a clear net benefit. You're losing some opportunity, you're dealing with some of those risks about re-establishment and some of those ecological sort of things. I mean, is that an option where the area gets bigger, you know, the revegetation part of it?
And essentially, I think that's what they've sort of tried to do in their amended proposal, throw more at it.
Yes.
But they've changed the communities, and so what they're doing, is, and this is what I've said in my evidence, they're not placing under this plan and proposal, right. They're not replacing necessarily like for like.
No.
Ironically, the pallet that they're putting forward could be a like for like.
Yes,
if they just choose not to plant certain species, if they use that list. Is that list put forward as a palette from which to choose, or is that list put forward as it goes into the structure plan as these species must now be planted, and they will be required by the conditions of their resource consent to put those plants in, and they have to be represented in the planting. So that's my concern, is that there's a little bit of uncertainty about what proportion of which species is going to be the dominant on the site. But if you say, yeah, could they be asked to plant more? My approach to this site, as I said before, is protect, enhance, and then maintain. And so this short tussock group up here is the part that's really, really difficult to replicate. So a lot of what's in there can't be brought, and its transplanting is very tenuous in terms of the ability for that to succeed. And also, where will you put it? If you're trying to transplant what's in here, you need to find an environment that matches what's there. There's nowhere else that's rising ground, shallower, infertile soils that has the aspect and the environmental conditions that have enabled what's here to persist over time. If you try to move it over here, you're going to come into conflict with recreational use. And you have a smaller, even smaller area, and you need to almost make sure that this area is complete, and you're also crossing the line. You're crossing the section line, and so you're going into a different land ownership to hunt the spaces where if you did try to translocate, you could find a hospitable environment to put them into or a comparable environment to put them into. You can't just dig them up and put them over here because it's a different place. The ecology of this site is slightly different to here, and that's why that's not here. Right here. So from that point of view, that's why I'm saying don't lose what you can't replace in an acutely threatened environment with at-risk species. That's the fundamental point there. But in terms of replacing and planting and supplementary planting the Kānaka community,
then you could definitely follow the edge along here, and I would tend to expand the existing clusters with supplementary planting rather than step off and recreate an isolated cluster of planting that relates to screening the development rather than supporting the ecology of the site. So that's a tension between the management of the need to screen with the management of the ecology of the site. So yeah, you could supplementary plant that band through there and introduce diversity that's associated with Kānaka shrubland community and support that in a meaningful and significant way.
Yes.
Rather than substitute it and replace it with something different.
Right. All right. Thank you. No, that's great. Thank you.
Modifications that have been made to the proposal since it was notified, I would say that I consider them all to be positive, but I consider that the adverse effects on the character of the landscape of the vicinity are almost unchanged, and the visual effects are diminished to an extent, but remain reliant on, to a considerable extent, on planting where they particularly with regard to views from the north. And I think it's really well established, both in the environment court and in local hearings, that relying on planting as mitigation for visibility is alone is fraught with problems. The one point that I want to make about some of the alterations of the vegetation management, probably, you've heard Ms. Dawn Palmer, discussing it, but there are also, I would say that there are issues with the proposed rules regarding this, particularly to do with the application of what's essentially a landscape planting condition requiring diseased or failed to thrive plants to be replaced. This revegetation project anticipates the loss of specimens through time. They plant at really high densities in order, and the aim is to encourage competition between plants, and so inevitably you get deaths. And this sort of, I think revegetation projects are incredibly difficult to condition effectively or to create rules around effectively, because they have to be managed in an ongoing and flexible manner. And there was the other problem the part of the rule requiring that no short tussock grassland shall be removed outside the building platform of any lot. I would say that it should read no short tussock grassland species shall be removed, but that certainly isn't the only way of destroying them. I think mowing them would be the most obvious way and the most likely way that the short tussock grassland would be destroyed, and that would probably be particularly on Lot 21. In conclusion, I continue to consider that the existing zoning is the most effective way of managing what I consider to be an important remnant of the Wanaka Moraine landscape. And I'm happy to answer any questions, or try to.
Again, just on that, I guess that, you know, the viability, feasibility of the revegetation side of the equation, a lot of it is proposed on public open space, or, you know, land which will become public, and therefore it's presumably under council control, and, you know, there could be sort of more sort of hands-on management than the private lots, obviously. I mean, does that give you any more sort of confidence that
seeing the sort of rabbit infestation around the margins of Lake Wanaka, and the fact that the revegetation planting that is successful in the council reserves is done by community groups, doesn't give me any confidence at all on the front. I mean, I think it's a matter of resourcing. In fact, you know, revegetation projects are incredibly expensive and incredibly time consuming, and for any of it to be effective would have to be community based, really.
Yeah. Just looking at the, I don't know, we've been handed the open space zone, you know, that applies, and the objectives and policies that are relevant. I don't know if you've got that in front of you.
I do have it here somewhere. I think it's
chapter 20, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. When you read the purpose of the zone, it talks about to protect landscape values.
Yes.
Doesn't sort of say significant landscape values or, you know, big ones or small ones. It just sort of says landscape values.
Yes.
Yeah. Can we take it from that again that, you know, it's not confining itself to the ONL part of the spectrum or whatever it is that you might say. That it's sort of looking beyond, you know, there could be a... doesn't sort of qualify what landscape values it's protecting, I guess that's what I'm trying to get to.
Yes, it doesn't say that it should protect the landscape value of the outstanding natural landscape part of the open space zone, because certainly parts of the open space zone across Peninsula Bay are not, could not be considered to be part of the ONL.
Yeah.
They may have been, once, but are not anymore.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's
We had a bit of discussion yesterday there's the ONL. I mean, you read back the court, talked about ONL, and then the visual VLA, VAL, isn't it?
Yes.
But that's sort of a rural zone sort of conception or something, isn't it, really, the VAL?
Yes, visual amenity landscape can really only be applied to rural general land, and my understanding that those classifications, it certainly doesn't mean that Section 7B doesn't apply to other parts of the district that are not rural zone rural general. But those are the three classifications that rural can be made on rural general
land in order
to determine the assessment matters that are appropriately applied to resource consent applications.
Yeah. So in this case, we're sort of more in a sort of urban context, the urban situation. Maybe we'll get the O&L somewhere. Got the urban bit. There could still be some sort of intermediary sort of landscape categorisation or something.
Well, I guess, I mean, I suppose it would be open to you to decide that Section 6B... Section 6B applies to the northern side of the ridge, and Section 7C applies to the that 6B applies to the northern end of the eastern end, and 7C to the western. I mean, that would still be entirely appropriate, I think. No visual amenity landscape there, except possibly parts of Sticky Forest Ridge.
Yes. Can you, now I can't put the hands on the, we got a copy of that plan change, not plan change, variation 21 material yesterday too, so that was helpful. In the supplementary statement, and I guess it's more sort of in I'm not sure if it's landscape visual effects, but it's more the sort of it's not so much the northern side and the lake view and the rest of it. It's more the sort of Peninsula Bay, existing urban development, the existing urbanised part, and the sort of relationships there in terms of effects. Now, I mean, you mentioned that in your supplementary statements, but more. Can you just take us to that? Sorry, I didn't mark the paragraph that you were. You sort of rated the effects.
Oh, was that with regard to Mr. SB? Let me see if I can find that. Was that to do with Mr. SB's opinion that because they're localised, the effects are localised?
There is an impact there, but it's sort of a localised fact.
Yes.
So it might be a bit of a cost, but it's localised, therefore, put the two things together, A plus times B, you can get some small sort of thing.
Yeah. Right. I think that's my paragraph 3.3.1, I think we're referring to the supplementary evidence.
Yeah, 3.3.1, yeah. We visited yesterday the open space area, which is sort of just below the Sticky Forest area. There's a long band of open space,
yes.
I think, isn't there?
Yes.
The area, old area.
Area 2, I think it was, yes.
Yeah. And that sort of gave us quite a strong impression of the sort of, for want of a better word, the sort of urban development sort of nestled in to the sort of surrounding landscape.
Yes.
I guess how important is that aspect of it to the sort of visual and landscape qualities of the area, the wider area?
What exactly? Sorry, the.
Well, the sort of the sense of the sort of open of the sort of housing and the development sort of. Sort of nestling
I think it's very important. I think the boundaries of the zone as they have been defined are spot on in terms of the getting a positive relationship between an urban area and its surrounding landscape. Yeah. The curveball will in the future be whatever happens to Sticky Forest.
Yes.
But that can't be.
Right. No, we don't know what's going to happen.
Taken into account.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
I had a question, but I think you answered it. Your supplementary evidence. We had a discussion yesterday about just the landscape classifications and how they fit on land that's not so rural.
Mm. Right.
Because under the way the plan is structured, obviously you identify your landscape using DSS parameters and criteria in Section 5 to determine an O&L line or whatever.
Yes.
But if it happens and then the land is subsequently rezoned, does it sit within the rural zone? The owner one still remains, doesn't it?
Who knows? I mean, not really. You'd note that the line that the court accepted in the C10 2005 decision wasn't ever drawn on the Appendix 8 maps in the plan because it ceased to be rural general land and had a new zoning, so essentially the line became irrelevant from the point of view of the administration of the plan, because of course it had a new set of rules which were actually more rigorous than an L&L classification anyway. But that doesn't mean that Section 6B of the RMA ceases to...
No, that's right. I don't know the second point you made.
Yeah.
Do you have any comment on the relationship between this proposal and the Penrith Park next door?
Yeah, Penrith Park is... if Penrith Park were to be proposed now, I would be very hot on the northern end of the slope being protected and not developed down to Beacon Point because it's such an important part of the outlet landscape. And yeah, I think while it's really positive that the Stands and Kānaka have been protected throughout that zone and that will give that area a particular character, the actual development regime is quite permissive. And I think once we have a row of houses down that edge of Penrith Park, I think they will have an adverse effect on landscape quality, which really makes it more important still to protect the landscape quality on this piece of land, in my opinion.
Okay. Just on that, it is possible though, isn't it, to successfully have residential development and still maintain Kānaka. So if you look at the various subdivisions that happened over the last decade or so, like Little Mount Eye, for example, a number of those have conditions that say, yes, you can build, but you've got to maintain a certain area of Kānaka.
Yes.
So it is possible.
It is, but there have been numbers of times in recent years when concerns have been voiced about the fire hazard that is represented by the Kānaka around houses in Little Mount Eye. And now we have been, council engineers have recently trying to enforce defensible spaces around dwellings, which are quite considerable areas. In the realm of 4,000 square metres at least, which on places, if you were trying to impose them on areas like Little Mount Iron now, you would lose a huge amount of the Kānaka.
Okay, thank you.
Right, thank you. Short statement, that's great, thank you. It's sort of supplemental statement, so yeah, if there's anything there you want to bring forward, so
just a few points.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'd like to acknowledge the positive changes that we've seen in the last
few weeks, namely the deletion of lots 5 and 6, and I apologise, I think I refer to that as 4 to 6 in my supplementary report, and the improved maps with the tracks that we've seen as well. It's been great to see. My view and our Parks and Reserves Department view remains that the full 13.8 hectares should be retained as open space and ideally vested as recreation reserve. The forecast population growth in Wanaka and the visitor growth that we're seeing, in my view, creates a need to expand and supplement the existing open space and recreation opportunities, and importantly, protecting these for future generations. The character and size of this particular parcel of land offers informal recreation opportunities that are not available elsewhere in such close proximity to the Wanaka Township. Generally pretty easy walking and cycling, and certainly cycling distance for a lot of people. And that's particularly the case for protected public land. And I still believe that the inclusion of residential lots in this area will detract from future recreational experiences. Acknowledging that there will be proposed screening, but the presence of those houses will still impact on what is currently experienced there. I just wanted to make some comments around the park strategy review and how this would relate to the adjoining Sticky Forest area. Our preference is to not consider this area in isolation rather than in context with the wider network. And we believe, or I believe, that having our updated park strategy will be an important tool to do this. And the most appropriate method, in my view, for determining use and development of this area is through a management plan process, which may form part of a wider management plan. We might not do one for such a small area, but you know, it could be in context of a sort of adjoining reserves. And certainly a concept plan that was put out for consultation with the community and having their detailed input. And my reference to Sticky Forest was really to highlight the popularity of the mountain biking and running in the immediate area, and to demonstrate that this parcel of land, it naturally forms an extension to this, and it has the potential to enhance the trail network, but also that public access to Sticky Forest isn't guaranteed. It's not public land. Use of it is on an informal agreement. So it just highlights the importance of this area if Sticky Forest does continue to have public access, but if it doesn't have public access, then I think that the pressures on this area will increase. We're not looking to replicate the mountain biking experiences that are had at Sticky Forest. Obviously, this area is not big enough. But certainly some of those other informal recreational experiences, walking and running. And I also just wanted to make a clear distinction between the types of walking trails. Mr. Greenaway does point out that the creation of a walking path will draw cyclists away and minimise some of that existing conflict. But the trails that are there, the mountain biking trails, they are downhill, well not downhill, but they're single trail specific mountain biking trails that require a degree of technical expertise. In my view, probably at least an intermediate level. Walking trails or a specifically constructed trail here will attract parents with buggies, small children on their bikes, and the novice bike riders. So there will always be two types of users or a variety of users using these trails, which is why we were advocating for grade 2 at a minimum under the QLDC standards and specifications that council was adopted. However, in light of the topography constraints, the vegetation clearance required, and the fact that these trails at this stage won't be forming part of a wider commuter network, 1.5 metres probably is more appropriate should the plan change go ahead. And there is a grade 3 in the specifications that would allow that or that would relate to that. And regarding the comments around the informal nature of the trails and the lack of maintenance and the lack of input from council to date, well, the land obviously is in private ownership and we wouldn't be undertaking any planning or management regime for land that's not within council ownership. So. And I just wanted to comment a bit on the community partnerships. There are over in Queenstown, where there is public land with mountain biking tracks on them for council land, we have agreements in place with the Mountain Biking Club, which by and large is a pretty successful model. We also have agreements in place with Te Kapuna and the Kitapu Reforestation Trust for planting programs on council land. And I also wanted to highlight, in my view, the community volunteering in these organisations that undertake restoration and planting, that is also a form of recreation for many people. The stewardship and the ownership that they take of these areas, a lot of people do that because that's a high value experience for them as well. So there's a lot of focus on the track network that this area affords, but I also think there's other recreation opportunities that, you know, just people wandering around these areas, their interaction with nature, but also that opportunity to take care of this land and undertake some of these programs also as part of a recreation experience for all of you.
Thanks for that. One of the
aspects of the plan change, one of the things that has been proposed is a financial contribution towards some works elsewhere. You know, okay, there might be, and that's sort of a, in a way a bit of a sort of a compensation perhaps for the reduced opportunities in this area if the land gets, you know, rezoned, somewhat less opportunity for, you know, more trails and things. Oh, but there'd be a financial contribution that the council could use elsewhere to create a trail. Got any comment upon that proposal?
Obviously, any funding that enhances the overall open space network, you know, is great, and certainly the Review Park strategy is heading towards that. It's saying, can we use development contributions rather than on the specific developments? Can they be pulled to, you know, have a more strategic approach in the wider network? I struggle to get past the irreversible nature of this land being not available for future generations. So can you compensate for that loss?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yes. I mean, if it did proceed, this offer though, in terms of, oh, there's money there that could be used elsewhere, I mean, are there sort of projects that you could sort of pick up now that are sort of ready to go or get underway? In terms of that money that would come available to the for the track upgrades elsewhere in the Wanaka area, is there something similar that you could, you know?
Track upgrades in the Wanaka area, particularly biking. The majority of the track network is either in private ownership or on Dockland, and those community groups generally can access a pool of funding through Rotary or the Central Lakes Trust. That funding is sort of already available to them. And in terms of, you know, sort of wider, I mean, obviously there's always development projects happening on the lakefront and on other reserves, so I'm sure that the council could find a way to spend the money. But for mountain biking in particular, there's not a lot in Wanaka that occurs on council.
Council. I mean, did I take your point about that? Is it an equal trade, that, you know, in terms of the land, that opportunity lost versus what's been proposed in terms of contribution? Just on the contribution side, we had some evidence from the survey, Mr. Bottom, I think, which sort of set out the open space that had been provided through the Peninsula Bay area and its sort of, you know, relationship there with council's sort of normal requirements in terms of area per household, I think it was, something like that. And it seemed to be appeared to be quite a bit ahead of what the, you know, normal reserve contribution might be.
Yes.
Any comment upon that evidence?
The land that's already been vested is quite different in character to this land. It's quite formal, it's mown grass, it does have connectivity values in terms of pathways through it, but my understanding is that they're mostly for stormwater drainage purposes, the majority of the land, or they form a relatively steep embankment bordering the development. So it is quite a different experience in this area than it is in those more linear strips of reserve land.
Yeah. Any comment on usage? We've got what seems a fairly specialised mountain bike area there, the thread and needle track and so on. We look down the bank and we see the other company track. Different users?
The Beacon Point?
Yeah, the track that goes right around the lakeside, basically.
Yep, that's a different type of experience. It's not, you know, you're not an enclosed, you know, relatively enclosed forest, the trails aren't as narrow or as steep. And that Beacon Point trail does serve more of a, not so much a commuter, but it could do that as well, but it's, you know, it's more of a, it's not so technical, so it is a different type of experience.
Just trying to get a vision of it there, a little picture of the trails around that area in particular.
The most comparable, I believe, would be Dean's Bank on the other side of the outlet, which is accessed from the Albert Town camping ground.
Is it walking and cycling?
It's one-way cycle track, most of it, and it's on Dot Van. So.
Thank you. In terms of land that gets vested in council as reserve through the subdivision process, presumably once it's vested, council would have automatically looked to develop it straight away. Not all the time.
No.
So presumably, then the council holds, if you like, a bank of recreational land. Is it fair to say that the council would look to develop or utilise that land over time as the needs and demands of the community change or the community grows?
Generally, yeah.
But there was some concern raised yesterday, I think, that if the land was vested in the council, would this be left and become sort of rank grass and unmaintained? I'm not casting judgment on that, I'm just simply saying it was a concern, I suppose. And I understand from your statement that you wouldn't, well, I took your statement to say that you wouldn't start planning for the use of that site until council actually owned it.
Correct.
And so you could equally say that council may elect to do work years in equipment.
Assuming it would be vested as recreation reserve, the Reserves Act does require a management plan to be prepared within 5 years, I believe. And so that would be the preferred method is to first prepare that management plan. I also think that even though it is currently at the permission of the landowner, that there is a lot of value and there is a lot of use happening already that is meeting the community's needs at the moment.
And presumably you wouldn't normally have a management plan for every single reserve. You'd have an overall strategy that addresses such as you mentioned connectivity and all those things rather than dealing with each reserve in isolation.
Yeah, depending on the size and the type of the reserve, but there are a number of management plans that we hold that cover that suite of reserves.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, why don't we do that? We're just thinking about a short break now.
Yep.
So we'll just get a cup of tea and get up for just 5-10 minutes.
Okay. You can get one to come back,
Yeah.